Iran says its proposed resolution on nuclear disarmament serves as a benchmark for measuring the actions of UN member states against their claims. The UN Security Council calls for a ceasefire in Ethiopia, expressing deep concern over the escalation of fighting in the country's north. Also ahead, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry slams the UN and international community for their silence and inaction on Israel's crimes, including the recent killing of a teenager. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran says its proposed resolution on nuclear disarmament serves as a benchmark for measuring the actions of UN members against their claims. In a statement, Iran's ambassador to the UN said any negative vote by Western countries to Iran's proposal would expose their hypocrisy. Majid Takht-Ravadji said the West has always turned a blind eye to Israel's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction and instead pointed the fingers at Iran over nuclear proliferation. Takht-Ravadji underscored Iran's policy that WMDs, including nuclear arms, undermine global security, and a safe and a secure world would require the annihilation of such weapons. The UN General Assembly First Committee approved Iran's draft resolution last week. The Assembly is expected to vote for its final adoption in about a month. Political commentator Lawrence Davison says Israel is not only an obstacle to nuclear disarmament, but a threat to global security.
The United States will dismiss it as a ploy. They will say that Iran is trying to get nuclear weapons and at the same time trying to promote non-proliferation. And that's a contradiction. I'm pretty sure that's going to be their reaction. And of course, what the West will do, at least the United States, will try to change the subject or redirect the target of the effort to expose their own hypocrisy. See, so. I think it's a good resolution. I think we need to be reminded repeatedly of this predicament with nuclear weapons and the fact that Israel, in so many ways, stands as an obstacle to progress, not only with nuclear weapons and also but with international law generally.
The United Nations Security Council has called for a halt to the fighting in Ethiopia, urging talks to end intensifying hostilities.
They further call to put an end to hostilities and to negotiate a lasting ceasefire and for the creation of conditions for the start of an inclusive Ethiopian national dialogue to resolve the crisis and create the foundation for peace and stability throughout the country.
The council members also expressed deep concern about the growing violence in northern Ethiopia. They urged the warring sides to refrain from inflammatory hate speech and incitement to violence. The conflict began last year after the Ethiopian army launched an offensive against rebels in the northern region of Tigray. Fighting has intensified over the past weeks amid fears that forces of Tigray People's Liberation Front are now heading for the capital, Addis Ababa. The conflict has so far killed the thousands of people and displaced over 2 million others. Political commentator Abiyomi Azikiwe says the Tigray People's Liberation Front rebels are backed by the West.
The United Nations has called for a cessation of hostilities, which is very positive, although they themselves, due to the United States' influence, have been criticizing the Ethiopian government heavily over the last several months, to the point where President Abiy's government, Prime Minister Abiy's government, even had to expel several United Nations personnel. Obviously, the TPLF is being supported by very powerful forces. They have armaments, they have trucks with fuel, they have weapons, sophisticated weapons with bullets. So obviously these people are being supported heavily by the Western powers. And the question is the threat of that this poses, because the African Union Secretary is based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and considering the history of Ethiopia in regard to the even the birth of what we know today as human civilizations comes out of this region of East Africa. And this is not going to bode well for Africa as a whole. The AU secretary now is under threat due to the aggression by these Western-backed rebels. So the government should attempt to mobilize as many forces as it can to try to halt the forward march of these rebels from the TPLF.
Israeli forces have once again used the lethal force against Palestinian demonstrators in the occupied West Bank, killing a teenager. Regime forces fatally shot a 13-year-old Mohammed Dadas during demonstrations in Deir el-Hatab village east of Nablus. Demonstrators had gathered there to voice anger at Israel's illegal settlement construction. Regime forces also attacked similar protests in the town of Beita, south of Nablus and elsewhere, injuring dozens. The killing of the Palestinian drew a strong reaction from the resistance movement Hamas.
This blood shall be the fuel for our people's revolution, which will not rest until it achieves its goals.
The movement condemned the killing as a war crime. Meanwhile, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya called on the international community and rights organizations to end Israel's ongoing violations of human rights. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also criticized the international community and the United Nations for their silence on the incident and other Israeli crimes. It urged the International Criminal Court to investigate the regime's atrocities. Israel frequently uses lethal force against Palestinians who do not pose an immediate threat to its forces or settlers. Our correspondent in occupied Ramallah, Mona Kandil, has given us more details about the West Bank protests, during which one Palestinian was killed and scores others were injured.
Well, Palestinians have nothing but to keep urging the international community to act, to move, not to only condemn and slam the Israeli practices and proceed and the Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people. Palestinians are fed up from these statements. They say that if the international community wants really to move, they can do it. They can impose sanctions on the Israeli regime because otherwise the Israeli regime would continue to carry out the crimes and the aggression against the people of Palestine, especially here in the occupied West Bank. So Palestinians are still hoping that the European Union and the international community could move and impose sanctions on the Israeli regime.
Elsewhere, Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has condemned the new U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia as a show of Washington's continued support for Riyadh's warmongering. A senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the deal contradicts U.S. President Joe Biden's stated commitment to peace in Yemen. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi says the arms sale proves that the Biden administration has no real intention to stop the Saudi onslaught on Yemen. The Pentagon announced the sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia on Thursday. The $650 million deal is the first major military sale to Riyadh since Biden took office. U.S. weapons sales to Saudi Arabia have sparked global criticism, given the kingdom's devastating war that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. Sarah Flanders is the co-director of International Action Center. She believes the U.S. weapons sale to Saudi Arabia contradicts Joe Biden's campaign promises and serves no one but the arms manufacturing companies.
Well, this is just the latest U.S. breaking of commitments. Certainly, President Biden did again and again commit during the election campaign. He called Saudi Arabia a pariah state and said that all weapons sales would be ended. And of course, that's not what's happened. And this is not even the first. In September, there was a $500 million helicopter parts and maintenance contract that was signed. So this, along with the $650 million on air-to-air missiles, it's over $1 billion in U.S. direct supplies to Saudi Arabia. All the talk about leading with diplomacy and ending the war on Yemen, these are offensive weapons to be used against the resistance in Yemen, so it should absolutely be condemned. And the violation of President Biden promising to lead with diplomacy, and once again, its weapon sales, which benefit Raytheon and benefit the Saudi monarchy, but no one else.
One person has been killed in clashes between Iraqi security forces and demonstrators protesting the results of last month's parliamentary election in Baghdad. Over 120 people were also injured in the scuffles. The violence broke out when protesters marched on the heavily fortified Green Zone, denouncing the election as a fraud. In a statement, the leader of Asaib Ahlul Haq, a resistance party, condemned the attack on protesters, calling for those responsible to be held accountable. Qais al-Khazali also called on protesters to exercise restraint. Iraqis have been holding rallies across the country against the outcome of the October 10th vote. The initial tally put the bloc of influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in the lead. Protesters, however, say numerous violations were recorded during the voting and counting processes. The United States says it is prepared to impose further sanctions against the Nicaraguan government after the upcoming presidential election in the Central American country. A senior U.S. State Department official said Washington sees the Sunday vote as ushering in what he called a dictatorship in Nicaragua. The official noted that the U.S. will maintain its diplomatic presence in Managua despite limiting certain trade interactions. In the past months, Nicaraguan police have arrested a number of opposition figures for inciting foreign interference. This comes in the run-up to Sunday's election, where President Daniel Ortega is expected to win a fourth consecutive term. Camila Escalante says the U.S. sanctions on Nicaragua is to bully the Central American nation not to vote for President Ortega.
First, we've been the Nicaraguan people have been under threat by the United States, and we've been seeing this Renacer Act pushed and promoted by far-right members of U.S. Congress and the Senate. It passed earlier in the year by the Senate, and just this week, it was passed by the Congress. It was passed 4 days before the election, and now they are making coercive statements about their intention to issue and impose new sanctions against the Nicaraguan people 4 days before, 4 days with the Renacer Act before the election, and now just days before the election. They're doing that in order to scare off Nicaraguan voters so that they won't vote for the Nicaraguan government, because they don't want to have what happened in Venezuela or the blockade and its effects that we see in Cuba happening here in Nicaragua. They did this in the 90s as well. There was a big fear campaign, and because of that, the Sandinista government actually lost an election in the 90s because people were afraid and they wanted the Contra war to end.
South Korea's opposition conservative People's Power Party has nominated former prosecutor Yoon Suk-yeol to run for president in March 2022. The ruling Democratic Party in October chose a former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung, with the two staking out very different policies in what will likely become a divisive and close contest. Our correspondent Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the conservative People Power Party.
The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
Rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible because lies after lies continue.
I support Lee Jae-myung because he has gone through very difficult times and overcome everything by himself to get where he is now. And he is open and above board as well as firm.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Now elsewhere, the European Union has warned the United Kingdom of serious consequences if it tries to suspend parts of the Brexit treaty dealing with Northern Ireland.
We hear a lot about Article 16 at the moment. Let there be no doubt that triggering Article 16 to seek the renegotiation of the protocol would have serious consequences. Serious for Northern Ireland, as it would lead to instability and unpredictability. And serious also for the EU-UK relations in general, as it would mean a rejection of EU efforts to find a consensual solution to the implementation of the protocol.
Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Republicans claimed the governorship of Virginia for the first time in more than a decade on Wednesday, 3rd of November, electing the businessman Glenn Youngkin and presenting their party with a formula for how to exploit President Biden's vulnerabilities and evade the shadow of Donald J. Trump in Democratic-leaning states. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns. The piece is titled, Glenn Youngkin, a Republican financier, defeats Terry McAuliffe in the Virginia governor's race. Stay with us for more. Republicans claimed the governorship of Virginia for the first time in more than a decade on Wednesday, 3rd of November, electing the businessman Glenn Youngkin and presenting their party with a formula for how to exploit President Biden's vulnerabilities and evade the shadow of Donald J. Trump in Democratic-leaning states. Mr. Youngkin, a 54-year-old, a wealthy former private equity executive making his first run for office, elevated education and taxes, while projecting a suburban dad demeanor to demonstrate he was different from Donald Trump, without saying so outright. He defeated former Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat who, with Donald Trump out of office, struggled to generate enthusiasm among liberals, at a moment when conservatives are energized in opposition to Joe Biden. The Associated Press called the race for Mr. Youngkin shortly after 12:30 a.m., in the early hours of Wednesday morning, hours after the polls closed on Tuesday night, 2nd of November. The election took place at a moment when voters are deeply frustrated, weary from the still lingering coronavirus pandemic, and irritated at the cost and scarcity of goods. Large majorities in polls say that the country is on the wrong track, a foreboding indicator for the party in power. Mr. Youngkin's surprise victory, however, represents the starkest warning yet that Democrats are in danger. It was likely to prompt additional congressional retirements, intensifying the intra-party tug of war over Joe Biden's agenda, and fuel fears that a midterm electoral wave and Donald Trump's return as a candidate are all but inevitable. The MAGA movement is bigger and stronger than ever before, Donald Trump said in a statement on Tuesday night. In the first competitive statewide election of Biden's presidency, Mr. McAuliffe worked assiduously to link Mr. Youngkin to the previous president, inviting a parade of prominent National Democrats to campaign with him. The former governor sought to nationalize the race and effectively transform a gubernatorial contest into a referendum on Donald Trump in a state he lost by 10 percentage points last year. But voters appeared far more eager to register their frustration with the Democrats in control of Washington and Richmond, the state capital. And fissures appeared in the coalition of moderate whites, people of color, and young liberals that elected Joe Biden in 2020. In cities, suburbs, and exurbs that Joe Biden had handily carried, Terry McAuliffe margins shrank dramatically. Mr. McAuliffe never fully articulated his own vision of a second term and received no favors from Joe Biden or his party's lawmakers. They spent much of the fall locked in contentious negotiations over Biden's infrastructure and social welfare proposals, failing to reach a consensus that could have at least offered Terry McAuliffe some good news to trumpet. Democrats in Virginia have tended to win statewide elections on a message of can-do pragmatism. The stalemate in Washington cast the party in a different light. Taking the stage in McLean, Virginia, before the race was called, Terry McAuliffe thanked his family and supporters but did not concede. "This is a different state," he said, of Virginia following his governorship and that of his successor, Governor Ralph Northam. "We are going to continue that fight," he said. Significantly, Donald Trump appeared unusually content to be kept at arm's length by Mr. Youngkin, remaining mostly silent as a Republican candidate declined to invite him to the state. Terry McAuliffe even acknowledged to reporters on Monday that from a political perspective, it would have been better for him had the former president not been banished from Twitter, so Donald Trump could have had a platform from which to insert himself into the campaign. For Republicans, particularly those uneasy with Donald Trump and battered by the party's string of losses on his watch, Mr. Youngkin's triumph delivered a moment of exultation. Their win in Virginia demonstrated that they can reclaim some suburban voters without fully embracing or rejecting Donald Trump. Clad in a fleece vest and sporting a smile on the campaign trail, Mr. Youngkin happily claimed support from the so-called Never Trumpers and Forever Trumpers, while otherwise voicing a center-right agenda in a state where Republicans have not won statewide since 2009. In part because Mr. McAuliffe was so dedicated to his strategy of inserting Donald Trump into the race, Mr. Youngkin evaded scrutiny about his own views on policy, which on issues like abortion were to the right of most Virginia voters. The race illustrated that voters are chiefly focused on day-to-day quality of life issues related to the economy and to the pandemic, and they blame Democrats for failing to fully address these matters. The Virginia results also suggest that Donald Trump's exit has at least loosened the Democrats' hold on the college-educated voters who powered their gains over the last 5 years. It's highly unlikely, however, that the former President Donald Trump will let other Republicans sidestep him in the next year's midterm elections the way Mr. Youngkin did. The party's victory in Virginia may only lull Republicans into believing that Donald Trump no longer poses a dilemma and can be indefinitely averted, the sort of thinking many party leaders have clung to for more than 6 years. For now, though, it's Democrats who will suffer the most as their moderate versus liberal intra-party tensions flare in Washington and beyond, and officials blame one another for the defeat. Susan Swecker, the chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Virginia, was blunt in her criticism of National Democrats for their losses on Tuesday. "I would encourage those people across the river that could pass legislation to give relief to working families that maybe they better wake up and think about what next year is going to look like now," Ms. Swecker said. However, even polls closed on Tuesday, 2nd of November, when senior advisor to President Biden was fuming over talking points issued by the Democratic Governors Association, which pointed to the president's dimming popularity. "It was not Joe Biden," this advisor said, "but Terry McAuliffe who handed Republicans a political weapon as they sought to tap into parents' anger over local school boards." The moment came in September debate, when Terry McAuliffe said, "I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach." For Democrats, part of the reason the loss was so painful was because it was so familiar. It was a scenario that Democrats fear could come to pass again in 2022 unless President Joe Biden regains voter confidence.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us present you a brief but bright gem of an advice from the Holy Prophet's 10th infallible heir, Imam Ali al-Nabi al-Hadi, peace be upon him. "This life of this world is a market in which some people gain and others lose."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, recitation of the Holy Quran. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his beloved messenger, who is the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they have emphasized on the recitation of the Quran. A Muslim, when we talk about his lifestyle, we must see Quran and the preachings of the Quran in his lifestyle. And this cannot be gained without reciting the Quran, without understanding the Quran. When we talk about the recitation of the Quran, it does not mean that we talk about mere recitation. For example, learning how to read the Arabic words and just read those words without understanding what is said in the Quran. Recitation of the Quran means to understand, to read, and to apply what has been said in the Quran. Because in the Quran, there are many places where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, don't you ponder, don't you understand. So if it was merely reciting the Quran, reading the Arabic phrases, then obviously Allah wouldn't have said, don't you understand, don't you ponder. No matter the language that we speak, we must understand the Quran. And if it is not a language which we know, then obviously we should go and learn such a language. In today's world, we have many translations available, and therefore these translations can help us in knowing the meaning of the Quran, in knowing the message of the Quran. Therefore, we must try reading or reciting the Quran with its translation. We must read Quran with its translation so that we can understand what is said in the Quran and what guidance is provided in the Quran for us.
What do you see? Tell me, what do you taste? Tell me, what do you hear when I whisper your name? You see through my eyes and turn me away. In madness you spiral, if I did the same. Oh my love, I'm waiting. Oh my love, I'm calling.
IRIB English love, Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Shadowless, don't see me. Shadowless, as I can be. Shadowless, don't see me.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the importance of recitation of the Quran with its translation. In the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that we have sent down this Quran as a clear statement, and there is an admonition, and there is a guidance for those who are God-weary. Therefore, when there is a clear statement, means that everyone who reads the Quran can understand most of it. When there is an admonition, we ask people to give us advice. It is better to get advice from the one who has created us. And on top of that, there is a guidance. We look for a guide. We look for a leader. Whereas Quran itself is a leader. The Prophet was the leader. Therefore, when we are looking for an Islamic lifestyle, we should have a lifestyle in which the guidance has been taken from the main source, which is the Holy Quran. We should get this guidance from the Holy Quran. If we are looking for an Islamic lifestyle, we want some advice. The advice must be from the pages of the Quran, from the sayings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is revealed in the shape of Quran, in the verses of the Quran. Therefore, do not forget to recite the Quran on daily basis and get the advice, get the admonition, get the guidance from the Holy Quran, inshallah ta'ala. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A group of women are joining hands to protect one of India's key natural sites that is also on UNESCO's heritage list, the Western Ghats, a mountain chain that's facing severe deforestation. The 27 members of this all-female task force are doing all they can to protect the area's rare ferns, mosses, and thousands of other plants. They're using a variety of gardening tools and techniques to preserve species from all over the mountains. Not only that, but they also make artificial conditions and habitats for endangered species from other parts of the world, mainly those affected by climate change. One of the conservationists explained that what they are doing is actually helping the forest regenerate.
We have witnessed the birth of a forest, and that's a very powerful thing. You know, the mind is filled with the ghastly stories of forests being cut, like the Amazon or like the Western Ghats. But here we're witness to the birth of forests as well. And that is the forest itself birthing itself, you see.
The Western Ghats Mountains are home to nearly 5,000 species of flowering plants, but many of them are globally threatened. Only less than half of the area's flora is currently under conservation. Scientists say the outlook for the mountain is very concerning. Carbon dioxide is one of the causes of global warming, but can we get rid of it to save our planet? A Swiss firm has come up with a novel idea to store CO2 underground and turn it into rocks. Company Climeworks has started operating the world's largest direct air carbon capture and storage plant called Okra in Iceland. Located in Hershey, Okra is entirely run on renewable energy. It soaks carbon dioxide directly from the air and buries it as rocks deep underground to be mineralized. Usually, a natural process takes hundreds of thousands of years to turn the gas into basaltic rocks. But here, it takes up to 2 years for the CO2 to turn into white crystals.
Once the carbon dioxide is captured, it will be dissolved in water, and here we are at the injection site. The carbon dioxide dissolved in water will come through this pipe into the well, where it will be injected into the volcanic rock at a depth of between 800 meters and 2 kilometers.
The plant is said to be removing 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each year. The amount is too little to save the planet from carbon emissions, as climate modeling suggests the world needs to eliminate several billion tons per year by 2050. Here we have to take into account the saying of the head of Orca that we have to learn to walk before we can run. Legends never die. So 1 year after his death, Argentinians are remembering their hero on his birthday. And that's no one but that legendary football player, Diego Maradona. It would have been Maradona's 61st birthday this year. People all around the country, including in the capital, Buenos Aires, remembered their iconic figure in ceremonies over the weekend. In the city of Rosario, a giant monument was inaugurated in honor of the football star. You can see on your screens fans gathering there in celebration. They say Maradona's love still runs in the veins of Argentinians. Amsterdam, the capital of the Netherlands, is riddled with waterways through which thousands of boats pass each day. Soon, the city may also be hosting self-driving vessels. Amsterdam's Institute for Advanced Metropolitan Solutions has devised an autonomous boat that can cross the city's busy canals without the help of a conductor. The watercraft, named a rowboat, is the size of a small car. The developers intend to use the boats for tasks ranging from transporting people to collecting trash. They think it can also be used for less conventional purposes, like preventing oil spills or forming a temporary bridge. Amsterdam's authorities are considering locations for a trash collection pilot project starting early next year. One of the disastrous effects of climate change has been the loss of glaciers worldwide. People around the world are trying new ways to tackle this problem. Now, a team of Chilean conservationists have come up with a creative project to protect glaciers and prevent water loss. The project is called Nilus. Winter rains are collected in cone-like structures called stupas. Experts from Chile are using a technology that was first developed in India to make these man-made glaciers. The water is then later used in the dry summer months. Chile has been experiencing a severe drought for years. Nilus director Enrique Gilona says the project hopes to address water shortages in the country.
Here we are not creating new water. Water is something that is in nature already. It has a cycle, but clearly it has been affected by the effects of the great climate change, which we are facing. And we are looking for a solution that actually allows us to protect this water for a longer time in the mountain range, to be able to deliver it downstream toward the communities.
The goal is to store some 100 million liters of water across 50 stupas next year. This would be enough water to supply 100,000 people for 3 months. The first prototype was erected in park arenas, an area known for its glaciers surrounding a volcano, the highest parts of the mountain region. Researchers and activists have warned that glaciers in the Andes Mountains have been receding in recent years. They blame climate change for the loss of glaciers and water shortages. A photo on social media, an article, or a TV program can all draw attention to climate change. But to a German artist, nothing seems to be as effective as a journey using a giant wire ball to make his voice heard. Arndt Drossel started his journey from his hometown Paderborn, West Germany, 3 months ago. The trip has so far taken him through more than 60 cities. He has completed the journey to the Scottish city of Glasgow, the venue of a major UN climate conference. Drossel says he aims to tell people how they can help tackle climate change, now a key global problem. The German artist believes everyone has a duty to solve the problem to help next generations have a good future.
My wife and we have 5 children, and we want to give them a good and happy future. And everybody knows, I think, about the problems our Earth has, and we will have the same problem in several cities and countries.
The German artist says he has encouraged people to make specific promises to tackle climate change. He says his own pledge was to offset all his personal carbon emissions by using the sphere for his journey. Drossel says he will continue his efforts until the promises reach a million.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Me named Clarion, a homemade polar bear whose mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Hoss says Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where, you know, some of the problems are with melting ice caps. Not all the problems, because they're elsewhere as well.
Hoss says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on foot to reach the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow. Did you know that animals might have the potential to help tackle climate change? Strange indeed, but that seems to be the case according to scientists. The sheep on a remote Scottish island have a special diet that consists mainly of seaweed. This feature is what scientists are hoping can help reduce global warming. Sheep usually feed on grass, and the process contributes to methane emissions. But scientists say the sheep in Orkneys are unique because of spending the winter eating only the marine plants. Listen to one researcher explaining whether feeding seaweed into the sheep diet can actually help reduce gas emissions.
The main thing at the moment is we need to absolutely prove, one, which seaweed is going to be the best for this, what amount of seaweed into the feed gives the best effect, and then can you scale that up to a level where you would actually have an effect on the overall UK farming?
If proven, the Scottish sheep and their unique diet could lead to a breakthrough in methods for livestock breeding, which is a major source of greenhouse gases. Methane is about 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere.
Flocks of sheep are on the streets of Madrid. The animals have made their way through the center of the Spanish capital to follow ancient migration routes. Shepherds accompanied their sheep and goats moving through the streets of the Spanish capital. They actually marked a centuries-old annual tradition that began in 1994. The event allows shepherds to migrate their cattle from summer to winter pastures. They do so based on a deal struck in 1418 that allows the animals to walk through the city freely. The event attracts hundreds of people. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic, but this year, many locals came out to watch.
The Philippines is among the countries facing a soaring plastic waste crisis. However, a group of recyclers are working hard to tackle the problem, turning the waste into building materials. The group is called the Plastic Flamingo, or simply the PLUF. They gather bottles, single-use sachets, and snack food wrappers. The waste is then shredded and molded into post-add planks that can be used for decking and fencing. Their products are also durable enough to make disaster relief shelters and urban furniture. The group says the coronavirus pandemic has worsened the plastic waste problem, sparking a rush for protection equipment. Their disposal is a matter of concern now.
Because of the plastic problem we're currently facing, the pandemic, the huge accumulation of plastic use, there's also improper disposal. People are unaware on, you know, how do I dispose these plastics? Where do I dispose of them? So at the same time, we give that avenue also that instead of putting it in landfills or oceans in general, you know, you give it to the plath, you give it to recycling centers like us, and we would recycle these, upcycle them into better products.
The plath says surging online shopping is also another problem that they try to address. The group has collected over 100 tons of plastic waste since it started the business in 2019. However, they still have a lot to do. A UN report says some 300 million tons of plastic waste are produced annually, with South Asian countries accounting for 60% of it. A North Macedonian zoo has a new inhabitant. It may be small, but it has certainly sparked a big amount of joy. The baby marmoset was born 3 weeks ago. Its parents are super protective of their precious offspring. That's why zoo staff have not been able to get close to the baby and determine if it's a male or a female. The tiny primate will be given a name after its sex is known. Marmosets are the world's smallest monkeys. On average, they are about 13 centimeters long and weigh up to 100 grams. The adorable animals can be found in a number of countries in the Americas.
The hustle and bustle of modern life has made it difficult to communicate with nature the way humans used to do a few decades ago. Now a giant statue in the state of New York reminds us of the importance of lending an attentive ear to our surroundings. The massive statue, named Water's Soul, is located along the Hudson River. Her woman's head, with her index finger pressing on her lips, seems she's asking bystanders to maintain silence. It's a work of 66-year-old Spanish artist Juanme Palenza. He says the message of his work is, quote, to call on people to listen to the profound noise of the water talking to us. Water's Soul was made of polyester resin, fiberglass, and marble dust at a Barcelona studio. It was later shipped to its Jersey City site for assembly. The sculpture is 24 meters tall.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
While many in 1990s and early 2000s predicted that the internet would bring people closer together and usher in a golden era of free information and communication, in the cold light of day, it appears to have done exactly the opposite, pushing people into artificial bubbles insulated from those with differing opinions, helping to lead to a situation where Americans are more polarized than ever, and barely able to share a dinner table with their extended family. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is titled, The U.S. Broken Media. Stay tuned for more. In the United States of America, virtually nobody trusts what they read anymore. The United States ranks dead last among 46 nations surveyed in confidence in the press. Only 29% of Americans say they broadly believe what they read, see, or hear in mainstream media. And more than three-quarters of the American public think that big outlets knowingly publish fake news. The term fake news first came into common usage around the U.S. contentious 2016 election, where both the Trump and Clinton campaigns attempt to weaponize the term against their opponents. Clinton claimed that Trump was being buoyed by false information put out by Eastern European bloggers and shared on sites like Facebook, when Trump shot back at her, claiming the likes of Clinton supporting networks, CNN and MSNBC, were themselves fake news. Dr. Nolan Higdon, author and university lecturer of history and media studies at California State University, East Bay, and Mickey Hoff, professor of social science, history, and journalism at Diablo Valley College in California, and the director of the Critical Media Literacy Organization Project, Censored, have written extensively about the censorship, fake news, disinformation, and the prevalence of conspiracy theories in this free-flowing discussion in the United States. Together, the pair have written two books, The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It, and the forthcoming work, Let's Agree to Disagree, a critical thinking guide to communication, conflict management, and critical media literacy. Both are experts in critical media literacy, journalism, and the history of propaganda. The power and divisiveness of social media have again been in the news recently, with former Facebook product manager Frances Haugen having claimed that the social media giant, used by 2.9 billion people worldwide for news and entertainment, had consciously promoted divisive and inflammatory content to its users in the belief that it would generate more interest and revenue for the company, despite the dire consequences it has on society. While many in 1990s and early 2000s predicted that the internet would bring people closer together and usher in a golden era of free information and communication, in the cold light of day, it appears to have done exactly the opposite, pushing people into artificial bubbles insulated from those with differing opinions, helping to lead to a situation where Americans are more polarized than ever and barely able to share a dinner table with their extended family. Hoff and Higdon agreed that fake news and disinformation are a major problem in the U.S., but that the most pernicious examples of it do not come from Macedonian bloggers or from the gutter press, but from the biggest and most established news outlets, many of whom were integral in selling America's wars in the West Asia and North Africa region to the public.